my intention to focus on only an aspect of the use and abuse of digital media, and to focus particularly on social media. I don't intend to review particular apps or products. I may make mention of some, but more about the principles. And I also want to turn the topic around. I don't want to talk about the use and abuse. I plan rather to talk about the abuse and then the use. That means I don't finish on a negative, but rather I can speak about how this digital revolution can be used in a positive way and can be used to our advantage. It's important to recognise that we're all here because of social media and because of the great use of social media. And I don't mean by that Andrew Allen sending emails or encouraging you to register on the web page, but really that's what happened 500 years ago. There was a revolution in social media. You kind of wonder, you know, Luther, the beginning of the Reformation, justification by faith. But Luther wasn't the first to discover justification by faith or to believe that. And there's always been a remnant of the Lord's people. And many unknown and some known, but all the way back through history, been those who have trusted in the Lord Jesus Christ as their Saviour and not trusted in their works nor trusted in the papacy. But why was it Luther that was used by God to change the world? What was different about Luther was that he went viral. Luther used digital media. Not digital media, but used social media rather. Luther, you could say, when he spoke and when he wrote, his posts were liked and they were shared and they were retweeted. And that's why the message that he proclaimed went around the world. Around 1440, Johannes Gutenberg developed the printing press. He based it on the existing technology of a screw press, but he was a goldsmith and he developed a process for producing metal movable type in large quantities. And over the next few decades, the printing press became a common feature of a lot of medieval cities. It's thought that one of the first products that Gutenberg's press produced was indulgence documents. There's a very satisfying irony to know how Gutenberg's press was then used to undermine all of that thought and to do away with indulgence documents. It wasn't that Luther or anyone else planned to use social media or planned to use Gutenberg's press. We see the sovereign hand of God in it, of course. But what happened was that Luther's work, it was received well, it was liked, it was sold, and it was printed again and again and again. There was no organised campaign. All the different printers would have their different motivations for printing. Very often it was just they printed what sold. And Luther's work sold. They weren't printed in vast quantities, but they would be printed, sold, and taken to other cities. And if they were liked, they would be printed and sold there and taken to other cities. Someone's calculated that 20% of all pamphlets produced in German-speaking lands between 1500 and 1530 were from the pen of Luther. 20% of all pamphlets. And Luther wasn't producing pamphlets until 1517. So in that short time, he produced a huge amount of work. And the first piece of work to go viral was the 95 Theses. You all know he wrote it in Latin. And he put it on a church door. He circulated a couple of copies, but that was all. But somebody, we don't know who, took that copy down. They copied it into German, and then it was printed and distributed. Luther wanted academic debate. But before long, the whole German-speaking world was talking about this and were aware of this. There was no issue with royalties. There's no issue with copyright. It was just that people liked it, it was shared. And before long, people were talking about this. It increased Luther's profile. And that allowed them then to go on and to share other messages and to speak on other things. And Luther quickly realized in his writings in afterward in German, he could deal in Latin, but he dealt in the language of the people. Literacy levels were comparatively low, but yet people, there was still a level of literacy. And of those who were literate, more could read German than could read Latin. They say that when the Roman Catholics responded to Luther, that very often they responded in technical and academic, impenetrable Latin. So even without looking at the falseness of their reasoning, people couldn't even hear their reasoning because people couldn't see it. See, pamphlets could be produced very, very quickly, and they were sold comparatively cheaply. And it meant it was possible to almost engage in a public debate. So we're told that Tetzel, the man who was selling indulgences when it provoked Luther, he responded, and Luther then responded to him. And then another man came back, a man called Sylvester Malzoni, and he railed against Luther in his dialogue against the presumptuous thesis of Martin Luther and called him a leper with a brain of brass and a nose of iron. And he dismissed his arguments on the basis of papal authority. And Luther responded only 2 days later. And that's amazing, isn't it? He responded 2 days later. Here's his public response. He said, "I am sorry now that I despise Tetzel. Ridiculous as he was more acute than you. You cite no scripture. You give no reasons." And I quote that because I like Luther's humour. But that's the tone of what you would call a tweet today, isn't it? That's the sort of tone you get from President Trump. Somebody just dismissive. It's humorous, and yet, and it's social media. I mean, the 95 Theses were far from being clear statements of evangelical theology, but the constant interaction that Luther had personally, but also through social media, it sharpened his thinking and it refined his conclusions. And then when Luther's works were burnt, I mean, that has some symbolic significance, but no practical significance, because his works were everywhere. The printers in Leipzig were forbidden to print anything by Luther, and they protested that their livelihoods were at stake because all they could print were the Roman Catholic arguments, and they couldn't give them away. And yet, folk were bringing into Leipzig anyway Luther's pamphlets and circulating them. Luther was to call the printing press the highest act of God's grace. The apostles, they travelled on Roman roads, but that wasn't the purpose of the Roman engineers. It was for commerce and for military use. And Luther used the printing press, though Gutenberg invented it for other reasons. And we shouldn't despise digital media and the opportunities that it presents us. I mean, this lecture, more importantly, probably the other lectures of the school, they'll be available and listened to all around the world. I mean, probably you and I have preached in places we've never heard of, we couldn't find in a map. But because of digital media, it's out there. Yet, it's important that we're wise. There's no good gift that hasn't been abused. We can rejoice in the printing press, but there's some terrible things in print. Neil Postman, who wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death, long before the internet and Facebook and things like that, but because he was talking about television, in his introduction, he compares Brave New World and Orwell's 1984, Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984. He says this, he says, "What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared were that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, the centrifugal bumble puppy. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny fail to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that our fear will ruin us. Huxley feared that our desire will ruin us. And Huxley undoubtedly was right. And with digital technology, it appears to offer us everything and to make life easy and to make our lives full of pleasure. Digital technology offers a sense of competence and connectedness. And yet, with a cruel irony, it demonstrates your incompetence and often emphasises your isolation. It's the ultimate panacea in a cruel world, isn't it? Because it can fix everything. Think of scientists and engineers are like the high priests, alchemists who can turn our dreary lives into gold. But while it might seem to emancipate, it also enslaves. Well, I want to think first of all about abuse. We've got 10 headings, 10 short headings under abuse, and then 10 short headings under use. Abuse of digital media, particularly social media. And the first is idolatry. It's a temptation, isn't there, to almost worship the machine and to think this is the very thing which will bring all that we need in life. It will satisfy, it will save. And yet in a strange way, these machines that we own, they very quickly seem to own us. You get a buzz or you get a beep and demands are made on you and they control how you spend your time. Secondly, is the way that this shapes our identity. There's a leaflet there, or a short article there by John G. Murray about the me generation. But I think you'd be better called the I generation, because that's the way that clever products are marketed, aren't they? That's Apple's way of doing it, but also it transfers across to a lot of other things. It's all I. And I suppose that I means information or innovation or something like that, but so much of it's about identity and about me, about self. You know, if you have a smartphone, somehow we seem to think that it implies that I must be smart, must kind of rub off. And Apple makes some great products, there's no doubt about that, but very often are marketed just as a way of making you cool and making you innovative and making you exciting. It's very easy to try to find your status and your significance in technology, either in the device itself or what that device can bring to you. And it said that actually when you get a buzz or a ring or whatever it is, it can be stimulating, so much so that there's a chemical release in the brain. It can be more addictive than alcohol and cigarettes. And that's one of the reasons why people are always posting, because they're always wanting responses. I remember working in a homeless hostel many years ago, before mobile phones were really caught on. It was just at the beginning. But you also had pagers. And there was this lassie, she was homeless, staying in the hostel, she didn't know where else to go. Poor wee lass. And yet she had a pager. She said, what do you have a pager for? Well, it's my boyfriend gave it to me. It means he can summon me anytime he wants me. And for her, it made her different and special. Here she was, life's just utterly broken. Here she is, she's on the streets and she's in the gutter. But she got a pager. And it's very easy to be like that, isn't it? Very easy to be busy and to be glad to be busy, to be seen to be busy, to be needed and have to respond. Well, we can abuse in terms of our identity, but also in terms of our image. I mean, Facebook have arguments with my wife about Facebook. I say, I just think Facebook's terrible. And she says, that's just because you don't have any friends and you don't want to speak to them. And I said, that's not true. I do have friends, but I don't care what they had for dinner. You know? I don't need to know all of that stuff. But there's a real temptation, isn't there, to nurture the superficial, the false, to create an avatar, project an image of what we would like to be. You know, an idealised sense of self. And Facebook friends, I think, are very often, it's a Facebook audience. It's someone that you can perform in front of and you can create a show for. And people become a brand. It's not about a character. And meanwhile, the real me is more and more detached from this idealised me, which is out there. And people think this is me. And the real me needs to just slink away back under a stone somewhere. And you all know about how it can be used in such a sinister way. You hear people grooming. Grooming on the internet. And it's very, very sinister, isn't it? They're creating a false impression. And they're luring people to interact with them. But it's not the real them. It's a pretend them. And they're going to take advantage of that. Now, you hear of cases of that. You hear of prosecutions of people who've done horrible things as a consequence of that. But I think there's a level in which that happens all the time on Facebook. This kind of grooming, this creating this false impression and encouraging people to engage with this not real you. Creating this image. An image of being in control and a vibrant spirituality, perhaps, because we're always doing stuff on social media and dealing with spiritual things. And yet there can be a personal spiritual sluggishness hidden behind that. Fourth, it can be used to insulate from reality. You know, when the world becomes mediated, that's media, mediated, becomes mediated through a screen, we're removed from that. I say that the millennial generation, that would be really those 18 to 35-year-olds, 25% of them check their phone over 100 times a day. 50% check their phone on average more than 50 times a day. 25% spend more than 5 hours a day on their phones. 50% is more than 3 hours of a day. And there's some millennials here. Maybe that's true of them, I don't know. And maybe you're not so keen on using your phone like that, but you probably all spend a lot of time at a desk with a big screen in front of you. And it's very easy to get caught up with that. Millennials have also been called the Peter Pan generation because they never grow up. And then maybe that's because so much of life is kind of artificial. It's just not quite real. It's mediated. It's a form of life. It's a view of life. And people complain that young people grow up too fast. And it's ironic, isn't it, that they do seem to grow up too fast, but they never actually finish growing up. So they never reach maturity. So they're engaging with things which are beyond their age, but yet they never get past these things. So men, or people who should be men, are really lads or boys, and they play with toys, and their toys are more sophisticated than what their children have, more expensive, but that's all they are. And then there's just the volume of information. You get 24-hour news, but really, it's 24-hour noise. It's not news. And Postman speaks about this, and he talks about how when the image predominates, it's connecting with feelings, not with thinking. It's not your mind so much. It's an emotional thing. And the news, so it entertains and it outrages. And then it's just lost in the next report. It makes no real demand of you, and it makes no real difference. A film made many years ago called The Untouchables, and it was about Al Capone. I remember there's a scene in it, and Al Capone is at the opera, and he's deeply, deeply moved. He's in tears as he sees what's played out on the stage. But as he's watching at the opera, his henchmen are murdering and destroying lives, and the image cuts between him being moved by the drama on stage and then real lives being really broken and ended because of him. And his emotion is exhausted in the opera, so he's got no regard for this reality. I think that's what happens to social media all the time. That's what happens in the news. So people are stirred and they're outraged and they're emotional. And there's a satisfaction in being emotional and feeling a response, but it just doesn't go anywhere. It just doesn't do anything. It doesn't achieve. People feel, you know, vindicated and they feel entitled, and just, that's all it is. You know? Your emotions are exercising, so you feel satisfied, but the guy next door is lonely and nobody takes anything to do with him. Fifthly, it isolates. Social media can isolate because it gets in the way of real relationships. And you see that. You see mothers on their phone and children pulling at their arms, and their mothers are too busy on the phone because they're dealing with a friend on Facebook or whatever it might be. It seems to result in emphasising people's loneliness. Because on Facebook, everyone's having a great time. So you've got all these pals, and all your pals are having their best day ever, and you're not. Because you don't, you know, you don't put up a post saying having a bad day. Though sometimes people do that too, because, you know, that's my next point, it's about insecurity, it's people seeking affirmation. So it can be played to extremes. There's this, I'm great, I'm not wonderful, or I'm terrible, I'm not wonderful. It's isolation and insecurity. Now we're going to the relevance, that's number 7. That was one of Postman's observations. That's what in Brave New World, it was things just lost in a sea of irrelevance. There's just so much. I remember the first time I ever went on the internet, I went with my friend Andy Murray to an internet cafe in Coburn Street in Edinburgh. I sat there, I just didn't know what to do. I knew how to work machines because I was easy and we're told, but I just didn't know what to look at. There was just too much. Now, I now know how to do it. I know what I'd look at and I can spend a lot of time doing it. But there's just so much, isn't it? You just get lost in a sea of irrelevance. It's overwhelmed. They reckon that you spend 7 to 12 seconds deciding whether you'll look at a website or not. They say that your brain is more active when it's sleeping than when you're viewing TV. And the internet is more interactive than television, but you're still viewing. And so the brain's not really functioning as it might do to its full capacity. My sister-in-law is involved in, or was involved in, producing material for schools, and she was doing that online and having discussion with teachers about how productive it was to have the information on a screen, because the screen's not a good way to read the information or to process it, because the screen is always flickering. It's not still. You can't rest and think, you know, it's doing something else to you, and there's a distraction in that. Yes, you can read it and yes, you can gain from it, but is it the best way? It's just that noise, the background noise. And then all the tat and all the trivia of people's lives, you know, as I said, what the hell for dinner? 8, abuse of social media, interruption. You know, when I went to study, I shut my door to keep my children out, but then I open all these windows. And sometimes there's far more destruction coming through the window distraction coming through the window, and there might be through the door. You know, and if there's concentrated thought, surely as a society, shallow thinking is a great problem. Everyone's got a view on everything, but it's not thought through. There's been no time spent on it. And we were told to be still and know that God is God. To be still and to take time to meditate upon the Word. I think when the brain is so overstimulated, you know yourself, you just can't rest. You can't sleep properly because your mind is just so much to process. And if you spend all your time filling your head with news and noise and information, then you'll not work well, but nor will you rest well. And it just becomes a vicious circle. I recently took email off my mobile phone, and it's been great since I did that. I did it before for a period of time. The reason I did it before was because I was sitting in the maternity suite with my wife who was going into labour, and I got an email from David Blunt. It's not his fault, he didn't know that's where it was. But I just thought, this is crazy. Here I am, my wife's going into labour. There's a child about to be born, and I've got committee stuff coming in. Another abuse is the need for the instant response. There's no time to think. Faster doesn't always mean better, does it? 1948, there was the Berlin airlift. It's a response to the Soviets having blockaded West Berlin. It was the issue of the day. It was the first major encounter or major crisis of the Cold War. And the Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, was asked by a journalist, "Do you have any comment on this, Mr. Attlee?" He said, "No, not today." And that was acceptable. But can you imagine the Prime Minister saying that today? Any comment on Brexit? No. You know, there's a demand for instant information. It seems that Donald Trump governs by Twitter. You know, on Twitter, you're limited to 140 characters. And if you use punctuation, that counts. And if you put a space between words, that counts. So you've got 140 characters. And yet, that's how it's done. And that just kind of perpetuates the idea that everything has to be instant, an immediate response, an immediate comment. There's maybe no wonder that politicians become experts at avoiding the issue. Because they're not able to say, "I don't know," or they're not able to say, "Wait a bit." They have to have an answer. So they kind of glide past it and pretend to have an answer. And it's easy to get caught up in that, isn't it? To have an immediate answer, to have an immediate response. Very easy to respond to an email and just send it off. There's these emoticons which have been invented to try to compensate for the dullness and the bluntness of communication, to try to add a layer of subtlety to it. And then the 10th misuse we identify is the thought that when you're on social media, you're invisible. And because you feel as if you're invisible, there's a temptation to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do. Tim Challis, in his book, The Next Story, he talks about the British Navy in the days of Nelson. There was an expression which is that beyond Gibraltar, all men are bachelors. At home, or even in other European ports, there was a sense of responsibility, accountability. There's a sense that you could get found out. You had to toe the line, you had to behave. But beyond Gibraltar, in the wilds, you were invisible. You could just live as you wanted. And that little device in your pocket, or that little device on your desk, which no one else sees, and which you can switch off, and which you can clear the memory off, and all these things, it gives a sense of being invisible. And then when you have all these apps which have self-deleting messages, so you can send an image or you can send some words and they'll vanish in a short time, there's a real temptation to say things, to show things, or to look at things with a sense that it won't go any further and it won't matter. Well, that's 10 abuses. I want to think now of how it can be used. And first of all, I just want to simply say, don't be deterred because technology is misused to think that we can't then use technology. I mean, that would be crazy to take this Luddite approach and just say, well, it's all bad. That would like be saying, well, Luther saying, well, we can't use Gutenberg's press. That's mental. Secondly, we have to recognise that as individuals we have distinct callings and we have distinct gifts, and we're to exercise our gifts in a distinct way, maybe in a particular congregation, maybe beyond that congregation from time to time. Maybe you're able to engage with a wide audience of people, but not everyone is, and you shouldn't then feel obliged, or we shouldn't all feel obliged trying to do that. It's wonderful to have Christian books, but we're not all called to be writers. There's more than enough books without all of us producing books. That would just add to the confusion. And so social media can be used to advance the gospel, but we don't all need to have a blog, and we don't all need to have a Facebook, and we don't all need to be tweeting. Some people have particular gifts. And the apostolic priority was for local preachers and local congregations, these local congregations, to be living together and therefore to be reflecting the gospel by their mutual love one for another, that men would know that they were Christ's disciples. And others might be drawn, might be challenged also, but might be drawn to join in that community. Remember Harry Woods having a few years ago a quote here, I think it was from John MacArthur, about being aware of the flat screen preacher. And there's a tendency in America where people just go and watch the preacher on a big screen and they don't actually engage with the preacher, and the preacher doesn't engage with them. Now, it can be great, it can be a wonderful benefit to be able to watch or to hear a sermon when you weren't present there, but it's important to understand that there's a limit to the benefit of that. Probably no preacher like the Apostle Paul, but there was to be other preachers. They weren't all just to depend upon Paul and Paul's letters, but there was to be local men preaching to local congregations. God has called you in a particular place, and you're to focus upon that. That's to be your priority. And anything you might do beyond that, it mustn't distract from that. It may flow from that, and it may add to that, but if it distracts from it and drains away your energy, and it drains away your time, then it's undermining the calling you've been given, and it's a failing. You're failing to fulfill your calling. It's important to remember, thirdly, that every tool has a particular purpose. You know, say that teenagers, they never phone because they're too busy using their phones for other things, and it's a misnomer to call them phones, really, because although they have that capacity, they're not used to speak, they're used for everything else. But you need to think about what tool you need for each particular job, and you should choose your tools carefully. All these different devices, they're kind of interchangeable, but they all kind of are better for one thing. So phones are actually good for talking on, because they're small, you can carry them in your pocket and you can hold them to your face. Whereas bigger screens are better for writing on or reading on. And you need to think about what it is you want to achieve. To use intentionality. Not just because you can do something, but why should you do it? Think of printing, You can print a massive poster, you can print a hardback book, you can print a softback, you can print pamphlets, leaflets, flyers, you can print postcards, you can print stickers. And you could use all of these different ways of printing to advance the gospel some way. You can have a big poster which says what time the church service is on, it has a gospel text on it. Or you can print a hardback book which contains theology for careful reading. Or you can print a flyer which invites someone to come to a service. But you wouldn't put, you know, your theology in a flyer. Your theological book on flyers. You need to use it appropriately and carefully. And it's the same with digital media. There's no problem with using tweets, but you can't use tweets to preach a sermon. You can't use Facebook to preach a sermon. Fourthly, it's good to recognise the opportunity that social media gives you to get past traditional gatekeepers. Donald Trump said without tweets he wouldn't be president because the media, traditional media, seems to hate him. But he bypassed the traditional media and he has over 100 million followers apparently, and he can speak to them directly. They reckon the Arab Spring was a result of social media because the powers that be in these nations couldn't silence the dissenters. They couldn't prevent them from speaking to one another and organising protests and speaking with the outside world and showing what was happening there. So social media can give people a voice, and it can give the church a voice, and it can allow us to speak to those who wouldn't otherwise hear us. Because you're not going to get interviewed in the BBC and you're not going to get a chance to present your view there. We would be excluded, but this allows us to be included. It's important not to let the media shape your message. You have to publish thoughtfully. You have to remember that people will observe your conversation. You know, you can say things to a friend, you can say some quite robust things to a friend. And in the context of that friendship, in the context of what you know about one another, that's okay. But when you're having a public debate, that's maybe not okay. It's open to be misunderstood. And although that comprises one of my 10 points of positive use, that's a negative, isn't it? Also, I want to say that it's important if you do social media to do it well. It's fair to say that out-of-date websites are worse than no websites. So it looks like you've given up and gone away. Because if you've never had one in the first place, then you've just not got around to it. And so if we're going to do these things, we have to do it in a planned way. And that might mean delegating. Because that's what ministers are great at, aren't we? We're great at delegating, get someone else to do it and just to leave it alone. But to delegate, to make someone responsible for it, so there's a named person, someone who will follow up and follow it through. It's important to always act with integrity before the face of God. If you're a pastor, a preacher of the gospel, you're a public person, a private person. And that includes your social media. It can be used to include people, to invite people in. Like Paul wrote letters to those who would rather have been with, but he couldn't be with, and therefore he wrote some of these epistles. And although he couldn't be with them, he was building, you could say building community. He was enhancing, he was enriching that relationship that existed, or a relationship that he hoped would develop. Our congregation in Spain uses the internet a lot. It's been used in some interesting ways. There's a family in Argentine who listen into the service as it's been preached. They're able to do that, and the time suits them to do that. And they're very glad. They're isolated. You know, they're a Reformed church, near them, no other opportunity for fellowship. And so they listen in. But then they asked, when it came to communion season, why should we be forbidden for taking part in the sacrament? We're part of this congregation, effectively. And so the Kirk session discussed this. And we spent quite a bit of time on this. And we recognised that this wasn't about private communion. This was about communion with the congregation. And why couldn't that take place through this live link? And so that was agreed, and that's happened. And I think that's a good thing. And so there's a connection, and that connection is confirmed that they're there and the congregation are there. And at the time is that people in Spain are sharing the elements together, so the family there are able to take part also. Although 95 Theses was Luther's, went viral, and that's what brought Luther to some level of notoriety and to public notice, it was maybe his sermons which were most helpful. So we said the 95 Theses, it was thinking in progress, wasn't it? It wasn't a finished product. That itself wasn't enough. But having seen how his 95 Theses was received, one writer was saying that it was Luther's sermons which he prepared for the print which positively proclaimed the authority of Scripture and of the need for faith that really established the Reformation. So that when he finally broke from Rome, well, people knew that it was biblical authority that mattered, and it wasn't the Pope that had the priority. So it was used in such a positive way. It's a temptation with social media to build a following, but we want to make disciples. We want to see men follow Jesus, not to follow us. And therefore, that should be in your thinking when it comes to using that. But while you can use it to invest in people, to try to gather people, to connect with people, those who are isolated, we should try to use it to bring people in where at all that's possible. And the people in the Argentine will never be able to come in to the Spanish congregation, but we really should be using it to try to bring people in. So not as an end in itself, but as a means to achieve something. And however much we may get excited by the opportunity of social media and these communities and these forums and these followers, it's important to build a real community and to think of our congregations as being a place where real people really matter. Because we live in a society which is exhausted by the superficiality of this social media. And if we can take time, and in our congregations take time, and for it to be a safe place where people can come and can be real, where they will be accepted as they truly are. And in the gospel, of course, there is acceptance for men as they truly are, as sinners. And there's freedom in the truth of that, isn't there? It's the truth that will make you free. But when we're dealing with people who come in, it's important to remember how shaped people are by social media and by our media culture. So people are distracted at the attention of a goldfish. You know, people aren't able to deal with huge theological sermons. That's why we have papers here that you wouldn't necessarily hear in the pulpit at home, because we're able to spend time here and to concentrate on them, but you wouldn't be able to preach like that all the time at home. It wouldn't be appropriate. And so we have to communicate, remembering, not dumbing down our preaching, but we have to communicate with people who have been dumbed down, and we have to communicate in such a way that these people can hear and can understand, and we need to think about how it's possible to convey It doesn't mean you should reduce your preaching to 10 minutes or to 5 minutes. But maybe you've got somebody there and all they can do is think for 5 minutes. And so that should be in your thinking. You need to offer ways back into the preaching if somebody's zoned out and is blanked off and just lost it. You need to be summarizing and you need to be persevering in the hard work with real people, accommodating their weaknesses and trying to lift them up, not just preaching beyond them and hoping that one day they will reach that level. The final thing I want to say is that we all need to take time to switch off. We need to take time to be still before God. We need to take time to think. We also need to be disciplined and we need to focus upon our own individual character. I hope these thoughts are helpful.
Any questions?